Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. Later in the programme, the bacteria growing on a piece of asteroid brought back to Earth.
You have to picture the scene. I'm first time looking at Ryugu. I am surrounded by a few undergraduate students who are doing projects with me. And one of them is so excited, she is falling off her chair. And all of a sudden, we see these really weird fibres.
But no, it's not the scary tale of planetary contamination you might fear. Also, the stories you can learn from 250 million-year-old poo.
If you really want to get at it, the best possible evidence is what emerges out of the back end of the animal.
A toiletry tale of the deep past. Our first stop is not new either, though, nor is it so old, it's an anniversary, a significant one. 50 years since what physicists call the November Revolution. What's as close as anything to the birth of the standard model of particle physics, i.e. the underlying rules, as they're understood right now, for the stuff we're made of. For decades now, since I joined the BBC, I've repeated this recipe. At the heart of atoms, there's a nucleus. The nucleus itself is composed of protons and neutrons, near identical twins, except the neutrons have no electrical charge. All this was clear 90 years ago. But continuing, the model says the protons and neutrons are built themselves of smaller quarks, which are held together by a strong force the theorists depict as a sea of gluons. It's like a mantra now, but the fog of theoretical conjectures that led to this picture culminated in a pair of experiments conducted 50 years ago in labs at the opposite ends of the US, New York and California, in which all became clear. No wonder they gave it a name.
At Stanford, we called it the November Revolution, which is a takeoff on the October Revolution of the Soviet Union. I personally think it was more like a volcanic eruption that occurred in the midst of a much broader revolution that led to the standard model of particle physics.
Michael Reardon, now a retired historian of science, was then one of the many researchers at SLAC, the Particle Collider Center in Stanford, California, where they examined the subatomic world by smashing electrons into their antiparticles, positrons, and used massive particle cameras to see what came out and to see what changed when the accelerating voltage changed. They had no idea that at just over 3 billion volts, something extraordinary was going to happen.
At SLAC, at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, we brought together beams of high-energy electrons and positrons. It was high energy in those days anyway, at 3.1 billion electron volts. And you had to be set right on the peak. Because it was so narrow, the energies of your incoming beam had to be set almost exactly at that total energy in order to see something. If they were not set at that energy, which was the normal case, you wouldn't see anything. But they happened to see a signal the previous summer and then went back to look at it in November 11th and set right at 3.1 billion electron volts, and there it was.
I mean, as I understand it, it's a bit like tuning your radio. You're slightly off frequency and it sounds horrible, or there's no signal, but they just tuned it perfectly and then the counters were sort of rocketing away.
Yeah, if you're off the peak, then you're just going to get static. If you're right on the peak, you get this big, high, beautiful signal. And that's what indeed happened. And you know, they like to remember that they had an audio every time they would get an event. So the speaker would click, and when they were right on the peak, it went click, 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 click.
Unless you're a physicist who's in this game, you probably don't realize how exciting that is.
Yeah, the director of the laboratory, Panofsky, came down when he heard the news, and he was just running around the control room with his hands on his head saying, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God."
Tuning through the collider spectrum, they'd hit upon something that was making huge numbers of particles, something was happening inside the collider. But what was a mystery, though it had to be a clue to the secrets of matter. What was also secret was that at Brookhaven Laboratory on the Atlantic coast, a rival collider taking a slightly different approach, smashing protons into a metal target, had already come across this same subatomic tone.
Yeah, in their case, in the Brookhaven MIT experiment, they were smashing protons with beryllium and looking for electron-positron pairs coming out. So in effect, they were looking at the reverse interaction, and they would take the energy of the electron and the positron, add them together, and come up with a mass of 3.1 billion electron volts.
The peak was not seen by running the experiment directly, but by analyzing the data afterwards. So it's different from SLED.
Saolan Wu was a young researcher on the Brookhaven team that summer as the collision data came in. But as she says, there was no rapid fire click, click, clicking on loudspeakers as the collider hit the right note. Instead, painstaking post-experiment analysis of the detector readouts showed things coming out of the collision mess that kept on having the same mass, equivalent to Stanford's 3.1 billion volts.
So in August, it's true that there's a peak around 3.1 GeV. It's a very exciting and surprising.
Saolan and her colleagues were quickly convinced this was something truly significant. But the experiment leader, Sam Ting, had seen other researchers humiliated by making premature announcements that turned out to be phantoms. He wasn't going to be making that mistake.
I think I remember introducing him in my book, The Hunting of the Quark, as a painstakingly careful physicist. But most physicists emphasize the pain rather than the care.
He built himself up by being a very cautious person to make sure what he gave it to the world is something which is correct. And the fact that we did not expect Stanford can do it so fast. Nobody can, because nobody knows the nature of this particle. Then we feel we have time to make sure.
But Sam Ting had run out of his allotted time at the Brookhaven Collider to make those additional measurements, double-check the apparatus wasn't tricking him. Others were queuing up to do their experiments. It was only by force of personality and giving a sneaky preview of what may come that he persuaded the management to extend his run. There were similar issues, in fact. At Stanford, over the summer, they'd upgraded their machine, given it extra power to reach far higher voltages. And aglow with Western frontier spirit, that's where most of the management, including team leader Burton Richter, wanted to head. But a few of the researchers wanted to revisit that faint signal they'd picked up just before the shutdown. Okay, they were told, you have till Monday.
The head of the group, Burton Richter, who became director of SLAC and also won the Nobel Prize in 1976, he wanted to barge ahead to higher energies because he was impatient to get ahead. And they finally convinced him in the 11th hour on Friday evening to go back for a weekend and remeasure these funny results that he had seen in the summer. Lo and behold, they discovered what became his Nobel Prize winning result. And I like to say they dragged Burton Richter kicking and screaming to his Nobel Prize.
As it happened, talk about coincidences, his co-laureate Sam Ting was on the plane to Stanford that Sunday for a routine management meeting to see Richter and his higher-ups. So he was briefly out of touch. But news of the excitement reached his team, who are still working at Brookhaven.
How did you feel when you learned that they had found the same thing at Stanford?
When there's a guy who came to the trailer to see Stanford, that was a weekend Stanford had a champagne celebration. We have tears in our eyes.
And that's because you had, for a week, been convinced that you had the results, but you'd sort of just waited.
I think we have it more than a week. But if you don't have competition, you know, a week or 2 weeks or a month doesn't matter.
For all the personal disappointment for those who thought they'd just found something unique, for the rest of us, the unanticipated race makes the story all the more compelling, and the double discovery made the observations all the more certain. But none of this explains why this physics at 3.1 billion volts would be a big deal. There are two reasons. One, that energy, think Einstein, it corresponds to a high mass, well beyond anything detected before. And the narrowness of the energy needed to tune into it, like an old radio, shows through some old physics thinking, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, since you ask, to it having a prolonged existence. It didn't fall apart straight away. Sam Ting underlined on BBC Discovery 25 years ago how unexpected this was.
All the particles we know has a certain property. They have a short lifetime. They have certain mass. The particle we found have two distinct properties. The first of which is they have a long lifetime. The lifetime is about 10,000 times longer than the other elementary particles, subatomic particles. Second, they're very heavy. They're about three times heavier than the mass of a hydrogen atom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, imagine on Earth, everybody lives 100 years. Suppose you suddenly found somebody, a family lives 10,000 years or longer. You ask why.
Yeah.
And why is because this is a new form of matter.
But a new form of matter that was anticipated in one of the theories of the previous decade. It proposed protons and neutrons were composed of smaller quarks, called up and down. And indeed, experiments at Stanford that Michael Reardon has been involved with had shown that there were hard things inside protons. They could be quarks. Another flavour of quark had been proposed, called strange, to explain the strange behaviour of some things that showed up in some experiments. But the maths of the theory just didn't work unless you added in a further quark called charm to offset the strangeness. It was quickly the candidate to explain what had just shown up.
When it initially appeared, there were three interpretations, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but the leading interpretation was that we were seeing the effects of the charm quark, that you would have a charm quark and an anti-charm quark bound up together in what was we called the psi particle, and the Brookhaven MIT people called the J particle. And because of the nature of the strong force between them, which paradoxically got weaker as the particles got closer together, these things could live in the vicinity of one another for a long time.
Nowadays, it's sort of taken for granted that there are these things, quarks. Reading around it, it seems to me that that was still pretty controversial at that point in 1974.
Yes, we had a lot of indirect evidence, primarily from our own MIT SLAC experiments, called the Deep Inelastic Scattering Experiments, that there were quarks inside protons and neutrons, but nobody had really seen them. But I like to say that the J-Psi discovery in the November Revolution was kind of like the slap in the face that made us take quarks seriously. Because after the dust settled, the only way you could interpret this striking phenomenon is by the existence of a new quark called the charm quark.
Which earned rival Sam Ting and Burton Richter a Nobel Prize just 2 years later. But it's not quite the end of the story. The Standard Model has those quarks inside protons and other forms of nuclear matter glued together. But it also needed gluons, force particles, to do the gluing. And those still hadn't been discovered. Step forwards again, Saolan Wu.
In late 1977, I went to the experiment called TASO. The head of the experiment was Bjorn Wick and Gunther Wolf and Paul Soding. They are wonderful people. And I had the idea of looking for reject events.
Now, I should point out, though you may have noticed this already, that single quarks have never been seen alone out in the wild. The glue force doesn't allow it. But bang quarks hard enough, and they will leave behind a trail of additional quarks, a bit like the wake behind a speeding boat, that bind together into additional nuclear particles, appearing in those atom colliders as jets of material. Jet pairs had been seen, corresponding to a quark and an antiquark recoiling from each other. But Saolan reckoned a gluon in the mix could add a third jet of matter if you hit things hard enough, and that at TASO in Germany in 1979, they just reached the right energy. She was right.
There was a conference in Norway, in Bergen, and Bjorn Wick, one of the three names I mentioned, he was giving a plenary talk. And I went visit him in Bergen and showed him the picture of the free jet. And he was really excited and showed that slide. And this triggered a lot of excitement.
Just over a year later, as a physics graduate, I had my first course in particle physics and learned about the Standard Model. This year, the lecturer told us, is the first time I can say the standard model is true. Last year it looked good, a few years before that it looked promising, but this year we know. And looking back today, I at last understand what a transformation had started with the November Revolution. The players have been celebrating it across institutions this month. And for a blow-by-blow account, I'd recommend Michael Reardon's Hunting the Quark, which is a great insider story. There's a link to his homepage on the Science in Action webpage, which you can find at bbcworldservice.com. Moving on, there are dinosaur discoveries to report most weeks. The biggest bone, the longest neck, the strongest legs, the sharpest teeth. We give most of them a pass here on Science in Action. But the most poo? Well, of course that caught my eye. Actually, it's poo accumulated on fossil sites across Poland that date from the Triassic period into the start of the Jurassic, the time over which dinosaurs went from their first hesitant steps on the planet to being the dominant animals. And it turns out the tiny details in the poo, I mean tiny, reveal things that no bone or tooth can. Per Alberg has made a speciality of fossilised dinners and was on the team scrutinising this excrement.
What we're wanting to understand is how these ecosystems worked and how they changed over time. And of course, the thing is, an ecosystem, right, is not a static collection of organisms. It's all about what they do, who eats whom, that kind of thing. And you obviously, you know, you want to be looking for evidence for that, right? Now, you can look at the anatomy of an animal, the morphology of an animal will tell you something about that. Shape of the teeth, that sort of thing. But if you really want to get at it, the best possible evidence is what emerges out of the back end of the animal. And the beauty of this is that actually, not only are those little sausages kind of common as fossils, commoner than you'd think, but their contents actually tend to preserve really well. I mean, obviously, everything in there has gone through the digestive tract and tends to be a bit beaten up as a result. But at the point when it emerges steaming out of the back end of the animal, it's got really good preservation potential if you can only get at what's in there.
So the idea is you go to an old dinosaur toilet, basically.
Yep.
Collect as many of these as you can.
Yeah.
And then you go take them to one of the top facilities in Europe where you shine x-rays through it.
Yeah, well, exactly. In our team in Uppsala, one of our kind of specialties is that we're making really extensive use of tomography. So in other words, the kind of 3D x-ray that you can do, you know, if you've injured your knee and you get taken to the hospital and you get put through one of those donut-shaped machines. But we do it using what's called a synchrotron, which is this huge electron accelerator thing that produces very, very powerful laser-like x-rays that kill you in seconds, but with something like a fossil, you can get very, very good images.
So you're looking inside the poo without actually destroying it, and you're seeing all the things that's left behind.
And we're actually a bit, you know, if I can puff myself up a bit here, we're the people that first hit on that idea, because we ourselves and various colleagues have been using this kind of tomography, synchrotron tomography, to look at, you know, fossil skeletons and stuff for quite some time now, a good number of years. But it suddenly struck me that this could be really good for coprolites, in other words, fossil droppings. I mean, it's like a kind of fossil sausage, right? The contents are all mixed up. There might be all sorts of interesting things you want to see in there, but they will be in no particular order. They'll all be jammed together, and there's no good way of getting at that mechanically. If you cut a thin section and stick it under the microscope, you can see that it's full of things. Fish scales, maybe, or what have you. And that's been done for a long time, but you get no overview of what's in there. Tomography, on the other hand, allows you to pull out all of the contents and itemize them, including incredible things that we'd never expected to find, like, for example, tiny beetles in some droppings from a Triassic site. Ditzy little things about like 2 millimeters long, beautifully preserved as though they were insects in amber. But in fact, little beetles in a poo, turning out to be the only fossil record of this kind of obscure insect group that still exists today.
So, I mean, the pictures in the paper are absolutely stunning. You know, I would have imagined that you look at one of these poos and basically everything had been broken down by the acid in the stomach, but there's all sorts of things.
Yeah, exactly.
That have survived.
Yeah, should be said it varies a bit from animal to animal. Crocodiles tend to be bad news because they've got very efficient digestive systems and everything just breaks down into kind of paste. But a lot of other coprolite producers, and of course, you have to appreciate, you know, I was going to say suck it and see. That's perhaps the wrong metaphor, but you see what I mean. You know, you put the thing in the scanner, you see what's in there. Maybe you're unlucky, but most of the time you find remarkably well-preserved contents.
And the point in this instance is that you and your team are looking through a critical period of the rise of the dinosaurs, from when they sort of they were a new invention in the Triassic, across the big extinction into the beginning of the Jurassic, which is classically the age of the dinosaurs. And you can see that their diet is changing over that time, or at least in the ones that you're looking at.
Yeah, exactly. So what we've done here, we're in this time period. To give a bit of context, this is in the aftermath of the biggest mass extinction the world has ever seen at the end of the Permian period, right? As things are starting to pick up again in the Triassic afterwards, the interesting thing is that while obviously you've got a bunch of survivors that have come through, the character of ecosystems change. New groups rise to prominence, notably the dinosaurs, which start emerging in about the mid-Triassic and then quickly expand until we arrive in this sort of world dominated by giant dinosaurs early in the Jurassic. So we want to try to understand why that happens. Part of what we're doing that's a bit different from past studies is that we're looking at one particular part of the world. In this instance, a bunch of localities from Poland. Poland very neatly has a lovely sequence of such localities from mid-Triassic up through early Jurassic, all obviously within much the same area and representing a part of the world that until now has not been well sampled for this time window. Most of the data we've had has come from places like Argentina or South Africa, some of it from the United States. That's valuable in itself, and being able to sort of look at what happens in one place is even better. But then what we've done is very systematically pull together as many different kinds of data we can obtain that give us pointers to what's happening with different aspects of the ecosystem. And a really consistent picture begins to emerge, which is most interesting. It's not just that, indeed, the dinosaurs rise, which they do rather gradually in a sort of some stepwise manner and apparently not really heavily associated with big, you know, events. That it's just sort of something that sort of happens step by step. But we also see how the network structure of the ecosystems really changes. Because early on, and perhaps this is a sign of like, you know, kind of rather damaged ecosystems hanging on after the end Permian extinction. Although, you know, we're looking at a lot of terrestrial animals, most of the food chains go back into the water. They start with fish, then you get fish eaters. Some of these fish eaters living on land, they're getting eaten by other animals, etc. Herbivores, minor part of the story. As we move forward in time, the herbivores become a bigger and bigger thing. The ecosystem begins to look more balanced because if you think about, you know, what's an ecosystem like on land today, of course, it's full of herbivores. Carnivores are a relatively minor part, right? And we eventually end up with that sort of balanced look early in the Jurassic. And now those herbivores are all early giant dinosaurs.
Because I sort of get the impression, and maybe I'm wrong, The early dinosaurs, according to this study, were basically they'd make do with anything that was around. They were sort of like the rats or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
And slowly they become more and more impressive. You start to get the big carnivores, but also you're seeing, like you say, the big herbivores. And it's a sort of specialization that's even in the stomach, in the diet that you're seeing.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're seeing. There's another angle to that that's actually really kind of interesting. In about the middle of our story, towards the end of, but not quite at the end of the Triassic, at a site called Lisovice, we have a giant herbivore. It's the first giant herbivore, but it's not a dinosaur. It's in fact the last survivor of a lineage called the Dicynodonts, which are actually mammal relatives of a sort and things that have hung on from before the end of Permian extinction. They were a they were a big thing in the Permian, and then the Triassic, they sort of hung in there, didn't really do terribly well. And typically, they were sort of about pig-sized, I suppose, were a little bit smaller. That'd be your sort of generic Dicynodont. But right at the end here, we have an elephant-sized Dicynodont. Actually, the largest mammal relative of any kind until, you know, after the extinction of the dinosaurs, when you have big mammals emerging in like the Paleocene and Eocene. Really, so it's like there's some sort of, there's an opening in the system for really big herbivores. And one of the last of these mammal relatives manages to get in on the act for a bit, but then evidently goes extinct. And from then on, all the big herbivores are dinosaurs.
It's amazing. One other thing is most animals, apart from us, on the planet these days, are also infested by parasites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gut worms and stuff.
Yes.
Do you see any of that?
Yeah, I mean, you get like probable parasite eggs and stuff like this in the droppings as well, absolutely.
I mean, sort of, it's weird. This sort of, it basically, I guess, even a dinosaur stomach is, in a way, it's an ecosystem in its own.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely so. And of course, I think there's an important point here. There's a little bit of a kind of, you know, philosophical point, the one that I like to bring home when I discuss this sort of thing. We think about, you know, now is now and then was then. But if this makes sense to you, there was never a then. There was only ever now. It's just not the now that we actually inhabit. There's every, you know, what I'm getting at here is that while the details of that ecosystem were different from those of today, in many respects, it was just as complex. Natural selection operated just as harshly then as it does now. All these kind of weird little niches will have been expected. I mean, you know, if there was an option for something that made a living drilling into eyeballs, it will have existed. You know, it sort of works like this. And I think this is, with this kind of sampling, we get to see some of these fancy little details in the ecosystem which would never really show up if we were just thinking in terms of big skeletons mounted in museums.
Per Ahlberg of Uppsala University. Search dinosaur poo on your newsfeed and you're sure to see fantastic micrographs of what his colleagues have just reported in the journal Nature. And now to those bacteria I mentioned right at the start of the programme, found on an asteroid sample brought back from space. And I'll reassure you straight off, there is no suggestion they've brought alien life onto our planet. But there have been other people claiming in the past that panspermia is a thing, that meteorites could spread life from planet to planet. And the new study shows how easy it would be to be fooled by a careless analysis. The asteroid was Ryugu, and we spoke many times about the Japanese mission Hayabusa 2 that swooped down to it and collected material from this orbiting space rock. What they shared with the Natural History Museum and Imperial College in London was, Matt Genge told me, tiny.
It is about a millimetre in size, but actually most of the things I usually work on are even smaller. So they are, you know, one third of the width of a human hair, most of my samples. So to me, it's a boulder. You know, I looked at this thing and I thought, you know, there's almost too much there. I'm lost, at a loss what to do with it. There is so much material.
So you pick this thing up, presumably with a very clean pair of tweezers. You put it under a microscope or something more powerful than that. You look down there and you say, hang on, what's that?
Well, yeah, so we actually looked at it in a scanning electron microscope, which was very exciting. And you have to picture the scene. I'm first time looking at Ryugu. I am surrounded by a few undergraduate students who are doing projects with me. And one of them is so excited, she is falling off her chair. And all of a sudden we see these really weird fibers. They look like fibers on the surface, just these little bits of string, really tiny, about half a micron in width, and that's about one millionth of a meter. And we just think, what are these things? And after about a few hours of coming up with really, really quite crazy suggestions, we suddenly realized they look very much like terrestrial bacteria.
And to be clear, this isn't what you were looking for. You were just looking to sort of what the minerals were. You're looking at, you're hoping to do a bit of chemistry and geology for a tiny bit of an asteroid. this is presumably a bit of a cog going in your brain to get there.
Yes, certainly. So the reason we're looking at the sample is we are interested in the rock and what it can tell us about the early solar system 4.5 billion years ago. Because rocks tell a story. They record in the shapes and compositions of the minerals a record of the events that have happened to them. So that's our interest. So we're not really interested in anything else in the sample. And so we see all these fibers, and initially we dismiss them. Oh, that's not important. And we concentrate on the minerals. And it's actually only later when suddenly I realize that these things are actually really unusual.
You say fibers, and just to be clear, these aren't bits of, I don't know, some cloth that you've been wiping on the material or anything like that. These aren't threads of cotton or anything.
Well, this is something we initially checked. Of course, you know, we saw these fibers. What are they? So we went around the lab, collected fibers from just about everything we could, including ourselves, you know, things like hairs. And we looked at those under the SEM. So I can confirm I do have split ends. And we noticed that all the fibers, even cotton fibers, they all have a very different shape. And most of them are a different size. They're much thicker and much longer than these strange little carbon-rich fibers that we can see on the surface.
So what was the giveaway that they were actually bacteria? I mean, that they were alive?
Well, initially we thought, well, maybe they are bacteria. But it was only the second time that we looked at the specimen, because there were more of them. And there were more of them growing in clusters around the indigenous organic material that was in the sample. And one of the best pieces of evidence that something is alive is it grows and it breeds.
And they're sitting there. So just to be clear, the bacteria you're looking at, that you're absolutely not making the claim that they also came from outer space.
Well, this was the thing. We were aware that there had been claims before that there were bacteria within asteroidal materials that came from space. And one, as a scientist, one has to keep an open mind. Now, that is a very unlikely scenario, because asteroids only have liquid water. And, you know, most of our chemical machinery that goes on in our cells occurs in liquid water. There was only liquid water on asteroids in the early solar system. And it existed for on a big asteroid, maybe up to about 3 or 4 million years. And that's such a short period for life to appear and then evolve into something as complex as a bacteria. And bacteria are actually quite complex. You know, they've got cell walls. Some of them are motile. They can move around. And that's very unlikely to happen over the course of such a short period of time.
But you also document in the paper how carefully these had been isolated when they were brought back down to Earth and then taken to the labs in Japan and then sent to you.
Yes, so actually, look, just last week I was visiting JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, and I saw their curation facilities. And these are these incredible clean rooms where, you know, you have to go through several airlocks just to get to the window that you look through into the clean room. You know, they minimize any terrestrial contamination at all, and everything is done in a nitrogen atmosphere, so they're not even exposed to the Earth's atmosphere. So everything that was done to that sample prior to arriving at us was ultra clean. Now, of course, we can't really work like that, so we had to take the sample out of that environment in order to study it. And that's probably where they became contaminated by terrestrial bacteria.
You see, in a way, the lesson I take from this is just how persistent bacteria can be. I presume that what's happened is there are the tiniest spores, despite your best efforts, and some of them have landed on this wonderful piece of material. They have no competition at all, and they just colonize it and gobble up what they can as quickly as they can.
Bacteria, terrestrial microorganisms, are the best colonizers on planet Earth. You know, it's what they've evolved to be able to do. And all it needs is one bacterial spore to fall on your specimen, and that's it. It's contaminated, it's colonized, and those bacteria are going to start to grow until they run out of resources or until the environment kills them. Because we did some pretty horrible things to these bacteria, like putting them in a hard vacuum inside a scanning electron microscope and shooting electrons at them at 20,000 volts. So, you know, they weren't particularly happy, but they continued growing for a while.
I mean, one thing I think is quite interesting about this, there is this plan to bring rocks back from Mars, particularly rocks which look like they may be interesting in terms of the history of life at the beginning of the solar system. It sounds to me like this just underlines how difficult it's going to be to get them back and do the studies without some kind of contamination creeping in at some point.
Yeah, the real problem is that bacteria are so good at colonizing rocks that if you give them any opportunity whatsoever, they can colonize and grow on that specimen. And it's a very sporadic thing. So, you know, you can prepare 1,000 rocks in your laboratory and none of them will be contaminated by bacteria, but then one will. So it's such a small chance. But that means if you find microorganisms, live microorganisms, growing in a specimen you brought back from Mars, and it has been exposed at all to the terrestrial environment, then you cannot be sure that those microorganisms actually come from Mars.
One other thing I wondered while reading your paper, you haven't cultured, or certainly not deliberately cultured, these bacteria, as I understand it, and you don't even know what they are yet. But are there rules about what you can do with things that might be living that have come from outer space? Because presumably we want to be cautious at the very least.
So if you think about microorganisms that infect us, usually it's microorganisms that have evolved to infect a mammal. So the really dangerous ones are things that jump between species, like from pigs to humans or from birds to humans. But these things have got billions of years of evolution behind them, allowing them to infect us, and in particular to escape our immune response. So we've been exposed to microorganisms throughout geological time, you know, all our ancestors, and we have developed the ability to fight microorganisms. And it's been an arms race between us and microorganisms about who is fittest to survive. A bacteria from Mars that has never encountered a complex organism like us, it does not stand a chance against our immune system. You know, the chances that a microorganism from a planet where there are no complex organisms that it can actually infect someone are extraordinarily low.
Reminds me of that story by that Imperial College alumnus, War of the Worlds.
Well, yes, certainly, but
lost.
I don't, you know, we've yet to encounter a microorganism that can build either a tripod or a death ray.
Life finds a way, even on sterile space rocks. Thanks to Matt Genge for that insight into real space science in action. Ending this edition from the BBC World Service, I'm Ron Pease. The producer is Alex Mansfield. We'll have a clean sweep of news stories next week.